change. Simply the deaths from particulates linked to fossil fuel combustion now kill almost 9 million people around the world. That's about 1 in 5 people who die on our planet. It's more than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. And none of it's needed because now we know how to take advantage of the large flame that the good Lord put 93 million miles away. We know how to use that in order to generate the power that we need, so that's what we should be doing.
Very quickly, Bill McKibben, Deb Haaland is about to be voted on by the full Senate. She would become the first Native American cabinet member in history, also very significant on the issue of fossil fuels. Your final thoughts?
Well, Deb Haaland is a great hero. It'll be wonderful to have her in that job because she comes from New Mexico, so she understands the importance of oil and gas revenues and the need to replace them as we move forward in this transition. But just the symbolism of it, Amy, couldn't be better. I mean, here's a descendant, a first Native American cabinet member, and she'll have control over 1/5 of the acreage across the country that was taken from her people over these last hundreds of years. It's a signal moment, one of many signal moments in this new administration.
Bill McKibben, author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org, thanks so much for joining us. That does it for the show. Happy birthday, Adriano Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor It Did Happen Here, the podcast producers, Thursday, March 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. This Zoom conversation is hosted by the Multnomah County Library. You can sign up for the event at the Multnomah County Library website under the events calendar for Thursday, March 11th. Selena Flores, Mike Crenshaw, and Aaron Yankee, producers of the podcast about fighting neo-Nazis in Portland, will answer questions about the process of making the podcast and the story and storytelling aspects. Again, that's It Did Happen Here, the podcast producers on Zoom. Registration happens on the Multnomah County Library website on their events calendar for Thursday, March 11th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Again, until every Nazi dies.
All you need is love.
Why do you love KBOO? Tell us what you most love about KBOO Community Radio, and we will use it on air during our next membership drive. Record a 1-minute testimonial using the KBOO mobile app, or use a voice recording app on your phone and email it to info@kboo.org. That's info@kboo.org. Thank you.
Love is all in it. Love is all in it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, COVID-19 cases are trending downward in Oregon as Multnomah County prepares to move into a lower-risk category on Friday. Jury selection continued today in the murder trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, and Georgia Republicans voted Monday to significantly curtail voting rights in the state. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 219 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday. In total, Oregon has had 158,000 cases of coronavirus. Health officials also reported 5 new deaths on Tuesday, raising the state's death toll to 2,303 people. Multnomah County will join Clackamas and Washington counties when it moves from the high-risk category to moderate risk on Friday. The move allows more people to gather at gyms, restaurants, and other indoor businesses. 9 other counties will remain in the high-risk category, with only 2 left in the extreme risk category. Nationally, the U.S. has reported at least 29.2 million cases of COVID-19 and more than 528,000 deaths. The country is still reporting nearly 2,000 deaths from COVID-19 every day. As of Tuesday, about 19% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with about 10% fully vaccinated. That's about 30 million people in a country with an adult population of over 300 million. Over 600,000 people in prisons and jails have been infected with the virus, and over 2,700 prisoners and correctional officers have died. President Biden said today that the country is on track to have vaccines available for every adult by the end of May. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 117.8 million people. At least 2.6 million people have died across the world. Public health groups are scrambling to try to find ways to make sure COVID vaccine doses aren't wasted. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Multiple groups are scrambling to find ways to make sure precious COVID vaccine doses are used by the end of each day instead of having to be thrown out. Some local clinics have resorted to vaccinating people who happen to be close at hand. Others have their staff members hurry to call in friends and family. Leah Russin with the advocacy group Vaccinate California is working with community groups in the Bay Area to create a more equitable system of waiting lists to improve outreach to lower-income communities.
A local community organizer, either associated with a Black church or a community center or a legal aid society, will have pulled together ahead of time a list of names of people that are otherwise eligible but haven't yet scheduled their dose.
A second site called HiDrB.com is gearing up to do something similar, but it is not yet active in California. Catherine Flores with the California Immunization Coalition says the problem is the sheer complexity of generating a waiting list that reaches the neediest patients while protecting people's privacy.
I think a lot of the states and a lot of the organizations were not prepared in a lot of ways. I think this is one of those things that they still are struggling with.
The state of California's website is myturn.ca.gov, where people can register to be notified when it's their turn to sign up for a regular vaccine appointment. Right now, however, only people over age 65 or in certain high-risk occupations are eligible. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Oregon Liquor Control Commission is deciding whether to set minimum prices on alcohol that would make the state's cheapest liquors more expensive, all the while the legislature considers a huge tax hike on beer, wine, and liquor. It was originally proposed by the OLCC on January 29th. The price raise could become official on April 8th with a simple majority of the 7-member commission, as appointed by Governor Kate Brown. Sazerac is the largest supplier to the OLCC and is the nation's largest distiller. They complained in a letter last week that price floors are wrong-headed. However, Oregon's largest alcohol maker, Hood River Distillers, is in favor of the minimum pricing. Company President David Ballou wrote to the OLCC, quote, "As shelf prices get lower, large national manufacturers often implement a strategy to lose money on these items solely for the purpose of squeezing out competition." Oregon liquor prices are already higher than California and Idaho. With the proposed price increase, Oregon prices would still be lower than Washington's. The first 5 jurors for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin's murder trial were seated today after a 24-hour delay. The jury selection began yesterday. It was delayed due to an appeals process over the reinstatement of an additional charge. Chauvin is on trial for the killing of George Floyd in May of 2020. Floyd was killed after Chauvin kneeled on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Floyd's sister, Bridget Floyd, sat in the back of the courtroom for most of the proceeding. Here she is speaking outside the courthouse yesterday.
I'm here today to represent my brother. You guys call him George, but I called him Floyd. I'm here to be his voice today. While I want to limit my comments on the trial itself, I will say that my family and I are glad the wait is finally over and the day is here. I sat in the courtroom today and looked at the officer who took my brother's life. I just really wanted that officer to know how much love Floyd had. Not only by me and his family, but you guys too, and the people around the country.
That was George Floyd's sister Bridget speaking outside a Minneapolis courthouse yesterday. 4 men and 1 woman have been selected for the jury so far. In total, 14 will be selected. Opening statements are expected to begin on March 29th, and the trial will likely take about 4 weeks. Racial equity groups working in Washington are getting a boost to their funding. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
Racial equity groups working in Washington state are getting a big boost to their funding. Kaiser Permanente is making a total of $500,000 in grants to 4 nonprofits in the Evergreen State to help them address systemic racism. Andrea Capane Sanderson heads Bird Bar Place, a community-based group helping improve health outcomes for Black Washingtonians in the Puget Sound area. She says people are listening to these concerns, such as the shortened average lifespan for Black Americans, especially since last summer's racial reckoning.
You have cross sectors, whether it's government, medical institutions, our grassroots organizations, and just community individuals who are now interested in collaborating and working together to solve some of these issues in our Black communities.
Other grant recipients are the Black Education Strategy Roundtable, Africatown Community Land Trust, and the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle, which is partnering with the Tacoma Urban League. Sanderson says her organization has been studying some of the health gaps for Black Washingtonians, both in urban and rural areas. They're now looking into solutions that could address these gaps. She says another issue involves health coverage.
We need to look at how the insurance industry possesses certain obstacles to achieving culturally appropriate but also quality care for Black folks.
The Bird Bar Place research involves speaking directly with people in the community. Sanderson says this is where answers for addressing health disparities need to come from, instead of from the top down.
If we're going to be designing solutions that will impact people on the ground, I think we need to be doing it early on, and this is our opportunity to do that.
The grants are part of a $25 million investment nationwide from Kaiser Permanente to address systemic racism and its effects. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with local author Grace Mattioli. We'll follow that up with News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO, with co-interim station manager Jenna Yokoyama. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 34 degrees, and tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 60. Today in history, in 1983, Janet Mock was born. Mock is the author of Redefining Realness, writer and director on FX's Pose, and a trans rights activist. The quote of the day is from Janet Mock, who said, quote, "I believe that telling our stories first to ourselves and then to one another and the world is a revolutionary act. It is an act that can be met with hostility, exclusion, and violence. It can also lead to love, understanding, transcendence, and community. I hope that my being real with you will help empower you to step into who you are and encourage you to share yourself with those around you." Republicans in the Georgia State Senate voted Monday to significantly curtail the right to vote. That's in the wake of surprising Democratic victories in the state in November and in January. The bill would repeal no-excuse absentee voting and would limit voting by mail to people who are out of town, disabled, or over the age of 65, a demographic that is much whiter and more Republican than the state as a whole. The Georgia Senate is also considering a bill that would end automatic voter registration, which over 1 million voters, a majority of them people of color, have used to register since it was implemented in 2016. Last week, the Georgia House passed a multifaceted bill that cuts weekend voting days. It restricts the use of mail ballot drop boxes and adds new voter ID requirements for mail ballots. The new bill even makes it a crime to distribute food and water to voters waiting in line. Stacey Abrams was the Democratic gubernatorial nominee in 2018 and is the founder of the voting rights group Fair Fight Action. Abrams said, quote, "We are seeing again and again this version of Jim Crow in a suit and tie because it is designed explicitly for the same reasons as Jim Crow was, to block communities of color from active participation in choosing the leadership that will guide their democracy." Republican Governor Brian Kemp is expected to sign all voter restriction laws being presented to him by the Republican-controlled Senate and legislature. The House of Representatives passed the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill today. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Probably all of us who have been around for the last 10 years or so have maybe given up hope that we could do anything consequential again in Congress. Well, we prove we can.
Democratic Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky expresses optimism about today's final House vote on the COVID relief bill. The $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan is then expected to go to President Joe Biden for his signature. The White House says, unlike his predecessor, Biden's name won't appear on stimulus checks. The bill received no Republican votes in the House or Senate, but Democratic Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina says most Americans want it.
76% of the American people support this legislation. 60% of Republicans support this legislation. This is bipartisan legislation. It may not satisfy the partisans on both sides of the Capitol.
Number three, House Republican Liz Cheney of Wyoming thinks the package could have been more moderate.
We could have had a bill that was a fraction of the cost of this one that could have gotten bipartisan approval and support, but the speaker decided to go in another direction.
Cheney is facing a potential challenge back home. Wyoming lawmakers will vote Thursday on legislation that would require runoff contests after a primary election if no candidate wins a majority, a scenario Cheney could find herself in. She's facing backlash since voting to impeach former President Donald Trump. Cheney is focused on increasing numbers of migrants at the southern border. She blames the Biden administration's executive orders rolling back parts of Trump's immigration enforcement.
Policy has consequences. When you say that you're not going to enforce our immigration laws, when you say that you're not going to build a border wall, it has consequences. And we're seeing the tragic consequences of that right now at the border.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says they're looking at new facilities to house unaccompanied children. Thousands have arrived at the border in the last few weeks. Axios reports that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California is leading a GOP delegation on Monday to the border in Texas. The House passed a major expansion of labor rights, although it faces longer odds in the Senate. The Protecting the Right to Organize Act would neutralize right-to-work laws in 27 states and give new protections to those wanting to unionize. Steve Smith with the California Labor Federation applauds Biden's pro-labor platform.
It was the most pro-union, pro-worker statement that we've seen from a sitting president since FDR.
The Washington Post says the White House will nominate big tech critic Lina Khan to the Federal Trade Commission. She's written that U.S. antitrust laws aren't equipped to handle tech giants like Amazon. In Minneapolis, jury selection continues this morning in the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin. He's charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter in last May's death of George Floyd. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Arkansas has passed a new law banning all abortions in the state, with the only exception being when the procedure would save the life of the mother. Governor Asa Hutchinson said he would sign the bill, while also expressing concern that it does not provide exceptions for pregnancies caused by rape or incest. Hutchinson said that the new ban, quote, is in contradiction of binding precedents of the U.S. Supreme Court, but it is the intent of the legislation to set the stage for the Supreme Court overturning current case law, in this case, Roe v. Wade. Holly Dixon is the executive director of the ACLU of Arkansas. Dixon said, Governor Hutchinson, we will see you in court. All three of the Supreme Court justices appointed by President Trump are vocal opponents of abortion. Besides Arkansas, legislators in at least 13 other states have proposed outright bans on abortion just this year. The Senate will vote on the nomination of Deb Haaland to Secretary of the Interior, led by Senator Chuck Schumer. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer moves to end debate and allow the Senate to vote on the nomination of Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior as Republicans try to stall the process. Schumer spoke on the Senate floor Tuesday about the nomination.
The Senate will begin the confirmation process for Congresswoman Deb Haaland before the week is out. She would be the first Native American cabinet minister and member of any agency and the first Indigenous Secretary of the Interior. A profoundly important moment given the historically troubled relationship between the federal government and tribal nations. Despite Republican obstruction, Representative Haaland will be confirmed by the Senate to be Secretary Haaland. I will file cloture on her nomination immediately after my remarks.
Senators Steve Daines of Montana and Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming are fighting the nomination, placing a hold on it, citing concerns for the oil and gas industry. The final vote on Haaland's nomination is expected to take place on Monday. Meanwhile, a number of tribal leaders, directors of Native organizations, advocates, and allies are continuing to call for Haaland's confirmation. They're making calls, writing letters, and taking their message to social media. The Cherokee Nation is now helping surrounding communities by opening COVID-19 vaccines to the public living within its 14-county area. According to the Oklahoma tribe, any member of the public, including non-natives, are now eligible for vaccines with Cherokee Nation Health Services. Vaccinations will continue for Cherokee citizens and members of other federally recognized tribes and their household. Appointments and charts are needed to be made at the tribe's health centers with an address in the 14-county area to receive a vaccine. Since mid-December, the Cherokee Nation has administered more than 31,000 doses of vaccines. Other tribal health clinics across the country have also moved to similar phases of vaccine distribution, including in Alaska, where tribal health systems have made strides in administering vaccines and then opened appointments to non-natives. The state of Alaska has now opened COVID-19 vaccines for anyone living or working in the state who is 16 years old or older. The Navajo Nation is hosting a virtual town hall Wednesday night to talk about transitioning the reservation from COVID-19 red level status to level orange. Data indicates a downward trend in new COVID-19 cases, a reduction in hospital bed use, and high vaccination numbers across the Navajo Nation. The Navajo Area Indian Health Service indicates 187,560 COVID-19 vaccine doses and nearly 76% have been administered as of Monday. Tribal leaders plan to discuss next steps in opening the reservation as neighboring communities begin lifting COVID-19 measures, including in Arizona and New Mexico. President Jonathan Nez says the tribe is taking small steps.
We'll go a little bit more about into the transition of opening businesses, churches, traditional gathering events, as well as get some information on schools and what information is needed to open up for at least 25%. Remember, we're not opening up everything 100% like Texas, right? We're taking small steps in our recovery here because we are a sovereign nation.
Over the course of the year, reservation residents have seen some strict COVID-19 emergency measures, including reservation lockdowns, stay-at-home orders, mask mandates, and curfews. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Folks living in the Amazon are using high-tech tools like drones to monitor illegal logging and protect rainforests. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Tropical rainforests trap immense amounts of carbon, so protecting them helps the climate. Conservation is also important to the indigenous people who live in the Amazon.
These communities really depend on their forests for everything, for their livelihoods, for their food, for their medicines, for their spirituality, everything.
That's Suzanne Pelletier of the Rainforest Foundation U.S. She says these communities have long managed their forests sustainably, but it's become increasingly difficult for them to prevent illegal deforestation. So the Rainforest Foundation is helping indigenous communities learn how to use high-tech tools to monitor their forests. By analyzing free satellite data, they can identify problems faster and more safely than they would on foot. Then they can investigate further using drones.
It's enabled them to collect evidence of illegal deforestation in places where it's dangerous for them to confront someone who may be doing that illegal activity.
And having geolocated, time-stamped evidence helps community authorities and law enforcement take action.
So it's a real integration of this new technology with traditional governance systems that we're finding is really decreasing deforestation.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The transportation sector accounts for 45% of Washington State's greenhouse gas emissions, and state lawmakers are trying to clean up Washington's fuel emissions so that a low-carbon future can become a reality. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
State lawmakers are attempting to clean up Washington's fuel sources yet again this session. Efforts in the past few years to pass a clean fuel standard have failed, despite the fact that California, Oregon, and British Columbia all have guidelines in place to reduce the carbon intensity of fuel used in vehicles. Vlad Gutman-Britton, Washington State Director for the group Climate Solutions, notes the transportation sector accounts for 45% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions.
There just is no low-carbon future without a low-carbon transportation system. And more companies, more and more legislators, more and more people in general are recognizing that and want to get this program to the governor's desk as a result.
Companies like Puget Sound Energy and Amazon have come out in support of the bill. Opponents say it would increase gas and diesel prices, hitting folks in the transportation sector especially hard. The bill has passed the House and is scheduled for a hearing today in the Senate Committee on Environment, Energy, and Technology. Gutman-Britton says Washington already produces some renewable fuels and biofuels, but they're exported to California and Oregon because of their clean fuel standards.
We produce the biofuels, but the benefits are accruing to people in other states. And while I don't begrudge those benefits to Californians or Oregonians, I think Washingtonians should get me too.
Gutman-Britton believes there is the potential to produce more biofuels in Washington if the state adopts this standard. For instance, he says dairy operations could create renewable natural gas from waste.
You have to handle and manage the manure. You have to handle the agricultural waste, things like that. All of that stuff is now potentially a revenue producer because it can be converted and will be converted into a sustainable replacement for petroleum.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants more kinds of vaccines.
In America, our states are more untied than united, disconnected, divided, beyond red versus blue. Arkansas just banned almost all abortions. Georgia severely restricted mail-in voting and made it a misdemeanor to give food or water to people waiting in line to vote. Too many voters ruins the profit margin. A couple more states lifted mask mandates and restrictions on businesses and groups. We're all so COVID-weary, we're spending hours finding a vaccine appointment, then announcing our triumph on social media as if it's both a golden ticket and a sign of moral superiority. The unvaccinated are selfish, anti-science, unclean. I want a vaccine that redistributes wealth, a vaccine that removes barriers to compassion, that opens our eyes to how connected we are with all forms of life on our planet. Some inequities and evils of human nature so deeply ingrained, we may need to isolate the gene for racism. Maybe start by examining the British royal family and cut it out. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Ken Jones. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9, it's Fortress on a Hill, discussing Daniel Sjorsen's book, Patriotic Descent. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, Investigative Journalism with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, interviews with locally and nationally known authors. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, featuring a preview of the virtual Portland International Film Festival. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Grace Mattioli, Portland-based author of the new novel, The Bird That Sang in Color. Grace's work includes a book of short stories, The Brightness Index, and two previous novels, Olive Branches Don't Grow on Trees and Discovery of an Eagle. Grace worked as a librarian in San Francisco for over 16 years and has held a plethora of jobs, including jewelry designer, food cart owner, shopkeeper, bookseller, substitute teacher, art school model, natural grocery store clerk, short order cook, food server, street vendor, barista, and a giant Twinkie. She's truly a Renaissance woman. In the words of writer Lydia Yuknovich, The Bird That Sang in Color is hugely moving, beautifully rendered, and brilliant. That's high praise, Grace. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken. I really appreciate it.
Now, your new book, The Bird That Sang in Color, joins your previous novels, and we mentioned the names Olive Branches mm-hmm. Don't Grow on Trees and Discovery of an Eagle. Mm-hmm. And it tells the multi-generational story of an Italian-American family from New Jersey. Can you tell us a little bit about that family, the Greccos?
Sure thing. My first novel is Olive Branches Don't Grow on Trees. And I originally started writing about this family because I wanted to kind of defy the negative stereotypes around this particular subculture, especially Italian Americans from New Jersey, which I'm a part of. And so the Greccos are neither mobsters nor morons.
And or disco dancers. I'm thinking of...
Right. No Sopranos or Jersey Shore stuff here.
And, yeah, I was going way back to John Travolta and Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, yeah, that too. Well, he was technically New York.
Yeah,
so,
I think
a little
Brooklyn,
bit different. But yeah. But still kind of the same. And there's just definitely that negative stereotype. And it's something that I've experienced my whole life, not as much when I was situated in my hometown in Hamilton, New Jersey, because there it's kind of like most everyone's Italian American. But I realized when I moved out of there that people really think negatively of Italian Americans. So I started writing about this family. And my first book was from the point of view of Sylvia Greco. And in this book, she is trying to make peace with her family, her very feuding family. And I needed to write something about something that I felt passionate about. So peacemaking is one of those things. all three novels are meant to not only entertain the reader, but also inspire them to live a happier life. So All Branches Don't Grow on Trees, the theme is peacemaking. With Discovery of an Eagle, the theme is living for the day, seizing the moment, living life fully. And with my new book, The Bird That Sang in Color, it's living from a place of freedom that is not conforming to society's dictates of how we should live and be. The main character is a Renaissance person and is also,
a focal point, though, of the novel. You're talking about Vincent.
A focal point. Yeah, Vincent is a Renaissance person and also lives freely and authentically. And the protagonist, Donna, is very much ruled by society's dictates and decides at a young age that she needs to have these certain ingredients in order to have a happy, fulfilling existence. That is...
The traditional ones, the nice home in the suburbs, the husband, and the kids.
The kids, the dignified career, and so on. And my whole feeling about the happiness thing is that I'm really passionate about it because I believe it's not only important at the individual level, but on the global level as well. And that's something I reiterate in all my blog posts and on my site, that if people were happier, there wouldn't be all the trouble in the world. And I believe strongly that it's the miserable people, whether or not they seem miserable, you know, externally or not, that are making all the trouble in the world.
You and just have to look at the White House and the former White House and the current Congress to see that. And you mentioned Donna Greco, who's the main character in the new book and also first person narrator of the book.
Yes.
I should tell the listeners that Donna is also the mother of the characters, main characters in your previous novels, Sylvia's mom and family. Also Cosmo's mom. And she starts out as a Tucci and marries a Greco, so that's how they get the name. And it takes us from her early years, so starting in 1970, I think when she was 13, to the present day when she's a 60-something grandmother. Mm-hmm. I want to get, though, to, Vincent. There was an actual Vincent, and he was your brother.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he died about 15 years ago, passed away. After he died, you found a booklet of his, which you call a pictorial autobiography.
Yes.
And that apparently led to the book and contributed to the cover of the book and all that, which we'll talk about.
That's his artwork.
Can you tell us what you found so powerful and generative about Vincent's drawings in that booklet?
Definitely. So I found it similarly the way Donna did. After he passed, I was in his apartment looking through things, and I actually replicated a lot of my own experiences. I found postcards that he had written to me and so on. And I found this book of his sketches. And I think I had sent you...
Yes, I looked
I
at all of them.
I sent you the album.
Yes.
And also in my new blog series, I'm featuring every one of those pictures. So that's something exciting. But when I looked at them, it was twofold for me. First, I realized that he had had a happy life because I was very much, I hadn't led a conventional life myself, but I was under the impression, like most people, that I needed these certain things in order to be happy. And I felt that my brother, who lacked these things, you know, like a spouse and a nice home and so on, you know, the whole nine yards, I felt that maybe he's unhappy and he would have lived longer if he was happier. When I found this booklet, this sketchbook, I realized his internal joy. And for me, I just felt this great weight lifted off my shoulders. Like, you know, he was happy and more joyous than many people that have all those things, that have the whole nine yards, and are miserable. And
You do a great job of contrasting Donna's chosen path, which is the more traditional, as society dictates what makes us happy, and then Vincent's which is a nonconformist, a Renaissance man kind of following his own passions and his own talents.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, Donna realizes, hey, you know, I'm the miserable one, and she was projecting all along that he was unhappy, projecting her own beliefs about what's necessary in order to be happy. So when I discovered this sketchbook, I was so heavy with grief, as Donna was, that it was enough for me to kind of extinguish my guilt about Vincent and know that he led a happy life and that I couldn't have done anything more to see that he led a happy life existence. But about 5 years after finding the journal, I had the same realization Donna had, that what pictures am I going to have of myself at the end of my life? And this realization was so powerful that I started to think of my life in terms of pictures. And I say in the beginning, I distinguish between photographs and drawings. So I started to think in terms of drawings, because I say a drawing is earned, a photograph is easy. And so I thought in
terms of
drawings.
You probably
don't
want to tell that to Ansel Adams, but.
No. But, you know, in terms of, you know, people can always take pictures of themselves, but what pictures will I want to draw of myself at the end of my life? So I actually started, I also draw and paint, but not as actively as I used to. But I started drawing some pictures of myself, you know, doing these things I wanted to do. I made a list. For instance, I wanted to learn the mandolin. I wanted to see the Aurora Borealis. What pictures am I going to have of myself at the end of my life? And that's this realization was so powerful, and it changed the way that I lived my life. And it was so profound, I wanted to share it with the world.
For you as a writer, though, I mean, your books, in a way, serve that purpose. But you also are interested in doing more of a pictorial autobiography. Have you already started something like that? You mentioned making a list of things that you do want to do, a kind of almost a bucket list. But have you started actually drawing some of those sketches? And
actually, I did. And one of my big things was to get my writing out there in the world, because, you know, I just written for myself for many years, and I wanted to actually start producing and getting things out there in the world. So one of my pictures is just a picture of me at my computer screen writing or writing in longhand. Sometimes I write in longhand as well. I started my list, and one of those, I hate to be this way kind of in a way, but I am really driven. I'm a little bit like a machine. A type A personality. So I did everything on the list plus.
Have you seen the Aurora Borealis yet?
I have.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm jealous. That's something on my list too.
It's amazing, but you really do have to plan well in order to see it. Like, you have to plan the certain time of year and the location and so on. And also then you're taking a chance, because there's a chance you won't see Aurora. But I actually stayed in a place in Alaska, in Fairbanks, that was solely intended for viewing the Aurora Borealis. They would wake you up in the middle of the night if they spotted it. So I did that. I didn't intend on being a jewelry designer. I always made jewelry as a kid, but it's something I started doing, and I actually sell in stores, in three local stores in Portland. So, yeah, I didn't intend on being a food cart owner. But, yeah.
Oh, what about the one I wanted to ask you about was the giant Twinkie.
Well, that was in a supermarket in New Jersey, in Ocean City, New Jersey, where I grew up. We lived in the summers. And I had a job as a cashier, but I could not hack it. So I tried. I wasn't very good at it. So I was demoted into working the deli at the hot dog stand. But there was some time in between that, and they needed somebody to dress up in this giant Twinkie costume in the supermarket and hand out, you know, and advertise for Twinkies. So that was me.
I grew up in New York, and I think we all said, when the world ends, there'll be only two things left, cockroaches and Twinkies. Because Twinkies last forever. I don't think there's an expiration date. So one last question, though, Grace. All three of your books, mm-hmm. do you consider them part of a trilogy telling the story of the Tucci and the Greco family, kind of like Vincent's favorite book, Lord of the Rings? Or are there still more stories of the family you'd like to tell beyond these three novels?
Well, I intended on it only being the three. And by the way, they can all be read as standalones, although once you read one, you might want to read them all. But the new book that I'm working on is going to be told from Vince's perspective, the Donna's youngest son. I wrote a short story about him called The Sane Ones. And it's a little bit more of a statement on basically my time at working at San Francisco Public Library's main branch for years. And, you know, a lot of issues that I've seen around the way America treats their homeless population and their mentally ill population. So, but there will still be humor in it and it'll still be entertaining.
Oh, we look forward to that.
But I want to add one more comment. I think a lot of people that kind of relates to this current pandemic, a lot of people are using this current pandemic as an excuse to kind of stagnate or stop living or stop learning and growing. And I say it's the perfect time to cultivate a new hobby or resurrect an old one. And I'm hoping that my book, my new book, is a perfect inspiration for people to do this, because it is a tribute to my brother, who was the most Renaissance man, the most Renaissance person I've known. So thank you so much for having me.
Grace, thank you so much for joining us at KABU. We've been talking with Grace Mattioli, Portland-based author of the new novel, The Bird That Sang in Color. You can find out more about Grace and all her work online at gracemattioli, that's MATTIOLI.com. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenna, and I'm also one of KABU's interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KABU, what's going on, what's